Welcome to the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. If you're just a beginning gardener or you want good gardening information, well, you've come to the right spot. Yes, you can grow tomatoes in containers. Maybe it's because all you have is a small sunny patio, or maybe you have lousy soil, or maybe you just want to be able to move those plants around. Well, with some help, of course. Well, we have tips on great containers for great tomatoes from nursery owner Don Shore, who loves tomatoes. There's a lot of fertilizers out there. Which ones are best for growing vegetables? Our local soil expert Steve Zion has tips for choosing and effectively using fertilizers for your plants. Our in-house college horticulture professor Debbie Flower solves the mystery of the browning citrus leaves. And we have a nifty trick for easily planting teeny tiny carrot seeds. Growing tomatoes in containers, fertilization tips, citrus leaf questions, and more. It's all on episode 11 of the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. And we're going to do it all in under 30 minutes. Let's go. If you have a sunny patio, maybe no bare soil, but you have a sunny patio, you can grow tomatoes in containers. But, and there are a few buts involved in this, you got to be careful. You got to know what you're doing. And that's why we're here for you today. Us being myself, along with Don Shore, who owns a retail nursery in Davis, California, Redwood Barn Nursery. And Don Shore, I imagine you have a lot of customers who do attempt to grow tomatoes in containers.
It's an annual event as tomato season rolls around of people coming in. I'm in a college town. UC Davis is located in Davis, California. And so we get a new crop of gardeners every year. And some of them come in and want to grow tomatoes, and they're in an apartment, or they have just a balcony, or they have no soil that really is suitable for tomatoes out in the sun, but the one sunny spot might be a little corner of their patio. So yes, we go through this every year, but boy, are we really going through it this year. Just a resurgence, if you will, or a new surge in gardeners who want to grow their own food, who want to grow fresh food, and are complete novices. And that's great. We love to see that. They have a lot of really, really basic questions.
I guess first we should start with, what exactly is full sun for a tomato plant?
Oh, I get that a lot. And, you know, absolute minimum of 4 to 6 hours. And a lot of people have just one side of the building. That's what they're working with. It's, you know, the east side or the west side. And those each have advantages and drawbacks. I want to see some direct sun on that plant for at least part of the day. I prefer, you know, full sun really means 8 hours. But it's pretty uncommon for someone who's growing them in containers to have that available. They're typically doing it up against a wall facing one way or the other. If I were choosing east versus west here in the Sacramento Valley, I would prefer east simply because a west-facing wall is incredibly hot. Other listeners in other parts of the country might find west wall works just fine because they aren't 105 degrees at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So I would say 4 to 6 hours minimum, and that's not technically full sun, but it's kind of the minimum.
All right, let's talk about container size, because I think a lot of people make the mistake of choosing too small of containers because the tomato plants they buy are itty bitty plants that they bought at the nursery that are only a few inches tall. So they think they're cute and they could go in a cute little pot, but not really.
Yeah, that's really, in my opinion, the first biggest mistake is not getting a container that's big enough. And I've experimented with this a lot. I would say the bare minimum container size for a tomato is going to be what we call a 15-gallon nursery pot, which you can find at nurseries, interestingly. Garden centers sometimes have them in the back used, and they might give them to you for a low price. I want it to hold at least a cubic foot of soil. This is what it really comes down to. 1.5 cubic feet of soil would be even better. And as it happens, what we call a 15-gallon nursery pot holds almost exactly 1.5 cubic feet of soil. So that may seem really big when you're buying, as you say, a 3-inch tomato plant. But the roots of any tomato, even the dwarfer types, go as deep as they can. They'll go 3 feet deep out in your garden, and they're not going to be able to do that in a small container. What happens here in the valley with a hot, dry climate is it goes along great in that little, you know, 2-gallon pot you think is going to be suitable for about 4 to 6 weeks. And at that point, you're needing to water it every single day. And at some point, you won't. And at some point, the flowers will fall off because of that. So it'll be much more satisfactory if it has a sufficient root volume. A really ideal is something on the scale or the diameter of a half oak barrel, you know, a wine barrel. That gives you loads of room. You can even stick a couple of other little plants in there if you want to for the early part of the season. But if you're looking for the bare minimum, in my opinion, 15-gallon nursery pot.
Let's define some of those terms, though. What are the dimensions of a 2-gallon, a 5-gallon, and a 15-gallon container?
15-gallon is about 14 to 16 inches diameter. There's no standardization in the industry, but it's what a big tree comes in. And again, what it really matters is the soil volume, 1.5 cubic feet of soil. A 2-gallon is only about 8 inches in diameter, maybe 10 inches, depending on the model. And that's not even big enough for a pepper plant, much less any self-respecting tomato plant. So you need a good soil volume. Every so often, as you know, having been in this business for a long time, a new product will come along that's marketed as the easiest, simplest, best, fastest, greatest way to grow tomatoes. We all remember the topsy-turvy tomato planter. Remember earth boxes, which are still out there. And I look at these, and the first question I ask as I look at it to try and gauge whether it will be successful, especially for a novice gardener, is what's the soil volume? And if it doesn't hold at least a cubic feet of soil, it's not going to make it through the summer here. There might be places where it'll work, maybe where it rains, you know, every day in the summer. That leads to other issues. But if it doesn't have enough soil volume, the plant will just dry out too quickly.
The 5-gallon container being between a 2 and a 15, obviously, and a 5 these days is what, about 10 inches across by 10 inches tall?
Yeah, a little bit, just about. And so that holds half a cubic foot of soil. I've grown a pepper plant successfully in that. I've grown basil successfully in that size, with daily watering in both cases. Just not going to be big enough for most tomatoes. Now, there are exceptions, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But for the most part, any tomato is going to fill one of those. The roots will be, it'll be root bound by July. So,
as you point out, ideally the half barrel, which is 24 to 36 inches across, depending on where you get those half barrels.
And three cubic feet of soil.
3 cubic feet of soil, but still you don't want to crowd it with too many tomato plants. I would suggest one.
Yeah, one in what I like to do is one, and preferably one of these dwarfer types. You know, there are some shorter types. And yeah, you can stick in a couple of little spicy globe basil plants when you first plant that tomato. And that spicy globe is a miniature basil that only grows about a foot by a foot, so it's not going to outcompete the tomato plant or vice versa. And you can harvest off that until eventually the tomato will be filling that barrel or that planter. So it's okay to combine a couple other things in there, but the goal is the vigor of that one tomato plant. I've had people, you know, walk up with a little window box and a couple of champion tomato plants. That's an indeterminate tomato. It wants to grow 8 to 15 feet, and it's not going to make it in a window box. It's just not a suitable variety, nor is the window box a suitable size.
Well,
the bigger, the better for containers.
Since you brought it up, define indeterminate and determinate tomatoes.
Oh, that's real basic. Your average tomato plant, 98%, just making that statistic up, of the varieties out there are what we call indeterminate. It's a vine. It will grow here in the Sacramento Valley or any place if they're truly happy, 10, 12, even 15 feet in a single growing season. And they continue to flower and fruit all season long, flower and set fruit, I should say, all season long. Your average tomato variety like Champion, Better Boy, Burpee's Big Boy, they're going to grow 8 to 10 feet minimum. So they're indeterminate. They don't finish up at any particular time other than when frost comes along and kills them back. Determinate tomatoes came along a number of years ago. They grow to a certain size. They flower. They set fruit. One big, long crop of fruit, and that's it. Well-known determinate tomatoes include Ace, one of the best tomato varieties all across the country. It grows everywhere, and it grows to about 3 to 4 feet, sets 20 to 30 good-sized fruit, and then it tends to be done by August or September, because it is what we call determinate.
What do we put in that pot? What sort of soil works best?
The richest, best quality potting soil you can buy. This is where you don't want to scrimp, because here's a secret. There's no standardization in our industry. There's nothing that says a potting soil must contain these ingredients. There's nothing that says the label has to be accurate with respect to exactly what its use is. So you run down to that inexpensive hardware chain, and you buy something called planting soil or planting mix, that isn't going to work. It's not going to have the nutrients in it that you need. It might not even be suitable for containers. So you want a good potting soil. And the good news is, in the last few years, the industry has understood that there was a subculture of people growing certain nefarious crops, which are no longer nefarious, in containers. And so they came out with really high-end potting soils with added organic fertilizers that will basically take care of the plant's needs all season. Well, it happened. The tomatoes fit beautifully in that category.
Now, you need to hold this plant up. Even though it's in a container, it still needs some sort of support.
Well, everybody has the fun experience of doing it the other way first, plant it and watch where it goes. It can be as simple as putting that planter next to a fence. You know, I know people who do that and train it like a vine up on the fence, even do a little pruning and strategic training and tying to train it as if it were just an ornamental vine. But the simplest thing is to just put a cage on it. And what kind of cage you need depends on which kind of tomato you bought. Those indeterminate types, you know, a 6-foot cage, they'll be out the top of that by the middle of July and cascading back down to the ground. Any cherry tomato, likewise. These shorter types, like Ace, one of those commercial tomato cages you buy would be satisfactory. A 3 to 4 foot tomato cage will hold it up reasonably well. There are a couple of tomato types that don't absolutely need to be staked. Roma, which is a well-known sauce tomato, just nice little compact plant, doesn't need to be staked at all. And there's a sort of a whole new category of hanging basket tomatoes, which are designed to cascade and just produce fairly small fruit on a relatively small plant. A good example is Tumbling Tom, which makes these little cherry-sized fruit on a plant that just cascades over the side of the barrel. But in general, yeah, you better get it up off the ground somehow.
And still, there are tomato plants that are fairly small in their eventual growth that do produce good-sized tomatoes. I'm talking about 7-8-ounce-sized tomatoes like Bush Beefsteak or Bush Early Girl. Maybe look for the word Bush in the name.
Yeah, there's a couple that came out that are compact versions of the old original familiar ones, and you mentioned them. There's Champion Bush, Early Girl Bush, Better Bush, which is a Bush version of Better Boy. Those have just shorter internode distances. In other words, the points on the stem are more compressed, and they're still good, full-size, good-quality fruit. Then there's ones like Ace, I've mentioned before, which is a very well-known large fruit. They're 3/4-pound fruit. You get maybe 20 of them on a vine. Really good quality. It's really an outstanding variety. Been around forever.
Stick with hybrid varieties. They're bred for disease resistance and production, and once you start feeling your oats, then you can go into the heirlooms.
And there's some truly miniature tomatoes, like Patio. Been around for a long time. Nice little compact plant that gets about, well, and I've grown, it gets about 2 feet tall. Produces, it's bigger than a cherry tomato. They're about 4-ounce fruit. You get 20, 25 of them on a plant over a long season. I mean, that's a really good one. Husky Gold and Husky Red are compact growers that have great quality fruit. 4 to 6 ounce fruit, which is about, you know, half the size of a slicing tomato, and very good quality on those as well. So you need to look around. At your garden center, you'll find 50 varieties at any nursery right now. And you got to poke around, look for that determinate or bush or something that says dwarf on the label, or ask if the staff isn't too busy for something that's got a compact growth habit.
All right, let's bring up the big reason why your containerized tomato plant is going to die, and that is irregular watering. Watering is the big issue when it comes to containerized tomato plants.
Yeah, in the Sacramento Valley and arid climates, there's no rain from, well, May through October, and so you're going to provide all the water that plant needs. And anybody who grows anything in containers in the West knows that you're going to be watering probably daily. Once it gets root bound, which will, in almost irrespective of the size of the container, will happen probably by sometime mid-July, that plant needs water every day. That's not that difficult if it's near a hose or you've got a watering can. Something for those of you doing lots of container gardening, can just a really simple drip system can be a way to go. Just run a 1/2-inch line behind the containers and a little bit of, you know, 1/4-inch or spaghetti tubing up into the container. You can run every day for a few minutes and take care of the watering that way. Make it easy to water. That's got to be the key to success for gardening in general, but especially trying to grow a big plant in a small pot. Make it easy for yourself to keep it watered.
Oh, by the way, did we mention that container needs drain holes?
So that would be important. Yes. No, tomatoes are not bog plants. You should definitely check when you buy to make sure. Here's another one. Some containers that you buy have a hole, but they come with a plug in the hole for one reason or another that you have to pop out. I've had to show this to my staff more than once. So check and make sure there's a drain hole in the bottom that actually is functioning.
And if you are buying a half barrel, you can drill some holes in the bottom. I like 3/4-inch holes, maybe 5 of them through the bottom.
Yeah.
And then maybe even raise that barrel off the ground with 2x4s just to help the drainage and also air circulation.
Yeah, I set them up on bricks, and I figure I make them perfect toad habitat that way.
There you go. Well, I think we got people started off on the world of growing a tomato in a pot, and hopefully they will be successful this year and come back for more next year.
lots of beginning vegetable gardeners this year for a lot of different reasons. And one of the best reasons is to have a ripe tomato from your garden in mid-July that you grew yourself.
Exactly.
That's a good way to get a whole new crop of gardeners growing.
Don Shore owns Redwood Barn Nursery in Davis, California. Don, thanks for a few minutes of your time.
Great to be here. Thanks, Red.
There are several ways to reach us here at the Garden Basics Podcast. Call or text us at 916-292-8964. That's 916-292-8964. Email your questions and pictures to fred@farmerfred.com or post your garden queries at the Get Growing with Farmer Fred Facebook page or at Farmer Fred on Twitter. We like to answer your questions here on the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast, and we always like to bring in Debbie Flower, our in-house horticultural professor, to give us some straight answers. And this question was texted to us via the voice number that we gave out, and which you just heard. And Debbie, Sam sent in a picture of his citrus. And there's some browning on the leaves on the underside. The leaves are kind of curled, too. That could be a problem. And Sam says, I have an orange tree and I see the leaves are showing brown spots. What should I do about it?
Well, I think it's just natural what we call senescence or death of the older leaves. What I can see in this picture is the leaf with the problems on it, the brown spots, and there's some yellowing too, is an older leaf. There's new growth on the tip of that branch beyond that leaf. And that's just natural for any evergreen plant to do. When they get new growth on the tip of the leaf, then the old growth senesces. And that's more, it's not just death, it's the plant reabsorbs the good parts, which includes the green, back into the plant, uses it for new growth, and drops that leaf to the ground. So I think that's all we're looking at here.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in the picture, though, because, yes, there are brown spots on the older leaves, but if you look at some of the younger leaves in the picture, and that's always the telltale sign, is what are the younger leaves doing? There's one or two there with green veins, but sort of a yellowing leaf, which could be chlorosis.
Yeah, citrus in particular are known for needing certain micronutrients. And the other thing I notice about those new leaves, and it could just be when the picture was taken, when in the life of the plant, or it could be what they are is small. The new leaves are very small. When we see the old leaves die off, turn yellow and die off, and then the leaves be small, that can mean that there is not enough nitrogen fertilizer being applied. So the micronutrients might cause often cause the green veins and yellow between, and then the lack of nitrogen can cause the new leaves to be very small. So to make this citrus healthier, Sam needs to fertilize it. Citrus are heavy feeders, and there is specific fertilizer for citrus. Follow the label directions and make sure that you apply enough water and not too much. I know that's always a tricky thing, but we gardeners always figure that out somehow. Right, Fred?
Oh, we try. We try. It's an ongoing battle. So, Sam, we hope that helps you with your citrus tree, your orange tree there. Debbie Flower, always a pleasure getting you in here to help answer garden questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody who's ever tried to plant carrot seeds knows the big problem. They're really, really tiny. How can you get carrot seeds separated? Well, you may have to use your kids. Today's quick tip comes from the brown thumb mama, Pam Farley, with a good idea on using carrot seeds, toilet paper, and your kids.
So something that I like to do to make it easier on the kids to plant the carrot seeds, because otherwise you're just going to have a big old jumble of seeds, is to lay out two or three squares of toilet paper, mist it with a couple of spritzes of water, and then plop seeds on the toilet paper, let that dry, and then place that in the garden. It's kind of like homemade seed tape.
How far apart do you space the seeds on the toilet paper?
I usually do 5 per square. You could probably do them closer than that, but that's easy for the kids to count and see.
Exactly. And they have smaller fingers too, so they can more easily move the little seeds around.
This is true.
Yeah, that's the first time I think I've ever talked about carrots and toilet paper in the same sentence.
Well, there you go.
But that makes
always breaking new ground here.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I like that because it is biodegradable, the toilet paper, and so you could plant that with 5 or 6 seeds on it. And hey, that's a great way to do it.
Thanks.
So you may think you're going to go to the store, buy some fertilizer, and go home and feed your plants. No. No, you're not. That's what my next guest will tell you. His name is Steve Zion. He is a podologist. What is a podologist? He's a soil expert. He has 45 years experience in organic horticulture and soil science. And Steve, so many people think that when they fertilize, they're feeding the plant, and the plant is not a straw, is it?
No, it's not. That's the old school, and they didn't take into consideration the billions and billions of microscopic organisms. For example, there are 1.8 million species of different organisms in an ounce of soil. If it's a healthy soil, you're going to find 8 billion microscopic organisms, and these organisms feed the plants water, nutrients. They provide pest protection and drought resistance. And so you want to feed these guys because they take care of the plants. And the roots actually exude chemicals that feed these microscopic organisms. And your typical synthetic fertilizer, they're high in salt. And salt is a dehydrating agent. And it actually kills and sucks the water right out of all of these beneficial microbes.
So let me see if I got this right. Down below our feet in the garden, there's these billions upon billions of little waiters and waitresses, and they're taking the food and cooking it, so to speak, turning it into something a plant can use, walking over to the plant roots, or maybe they're right there next to the plant roots, and the plant roots are so happy to get that food that these little critters have basically changed into plant food that they tip them with. With exudate.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah, up to 40% of the plant's energy goes to feeding that soil biology.
So every time we're putting fertilizer down on the ground and we're trying to get it near the plant, is that still a good idea, or should it be more broad-based as far as the area you're covering when you're fertilizing?
You want to go to where the root system is, and the root system usually is not by the stem of the plant except for this time of year if you're planting vegetables or shrubs and trees and plants that are still very, very small. Basically, the root ball is the size of the container. But otherwise, you want to go much farther out because the feeder roots are out typically where what's called a drip line, where the outermost branches are. And that's where you want to be putting your irrigation and your fertilizer out. And always use only organic fertilizers because that's what's going to feed the soil biology.
You mentioned earlier the fact that a lot of synthetic fertilizers have salt in them, and the salt basically destroys the soil life. And organic fertilizers don't have salt?
They have salt, but much, much less salt, a dramatically less salt, up to 10 to 20 to 40 times, depending upon the products that you're comparing. So the organic fertilizers actually stimulate the microbes. Many of the newer organic fertilizers actually have beneficial microbes in them, if you look on the label, and they will feed the soil as opposed to killing the soil as the synthetic fertilizers do. Plus, the organic fertilizers are for the most part water insoluble, so they move with the help of water placed on the soil surface, kind of through gravity and just as with the water flowing. As opposed to the synthetic fertilizers that are mostly water soluble. And with a lot of people having clay soils, if you put the fertilizer down and you apply the water afterwards, which is what you're supposed to do, if there's any kind of runoff, that's where most of the nutrients go.
And I would think, too, a water-insoluble fertilizer is going to last longer in the soil, so it's slowly feeding everything that's down there.
Right. So that also means less work because you're going to have to fertilize less frequently with an organic fertilizer.
But darn it, we're Americans. We like to apply fertilizers, especially those fertilizers with big numbers that say stuff like 25, 15, 20, referring to the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium content. Those three numbers you see prominently on any fertilizer. But in reality, plants and soil critters aren't that hungry. They could survive very well, thank you, on fertilizers whose numbers are single digits.
Oh, yeah. In reality, because of like I said before, the synthetics are water-soluble. So wherever the water goes, the nutrients go. So if some of it runs off, a lot of the nutrients are going to run off. They're not going to get into the soil. And then every time you irrigate, and you want to take that water down to a little bit below the root zone, that those nutrients will get leached down below the root zone very, very quickly. So they don't stick around very long. With the organic fertilizers, they're slow release. They're going to be there for a long period of time. And if you want to do, you know, regular fertilizing, add more microscopic organisms by putting down a good quality compost, or my preferred material is worm castings, because they're really, really high in beneficial soil microbes.
But as far as nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, they don't have that much in worm castings, do they?
No. That you're doing mainly for the biology and the organic matter. Organic matter is really important, some sort of compost or mulch on the soil surface on a regular basis, because that's a lot of the food and the energy source that these microscopic organisms feed on. The microbes are like a stomach, and so they take the organic matter that you're putting on the soil surface that moves down with the irrigation or the rain, and they digest that and put it into forms that the plants can take up. And most of these organisms live in what's called the rhizosphere, which is this area right around the roots. And so they're doing all of their activities right near the roots are, so the roots can produce those exudates and tell which organisms that they want to work harder. For example, if the plant is deficient in phosphorus, the plant will exude a particular chemical that will tell the microbes that make phosphorus available to get to work.
And they do it.
If they're happy to do it.
And they'll get a bigger tip later on.
Yep.
Okay.
There's actually what are called nematode trapping fungi. If there are nematodes around and the plant roots are being eaten by the nematodes, the plant roots will produce exudates that will tell these nematode trapping fungi to produce these little rings, and these rings exude a chemical that attracts the nematode. And as the nematode touches the inside wall of these rings, the rings fill up with fluid and trap the nematode. And then they dissolve the nematode and feed on it.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's a battle going on beneath your feet. And if you want to help, if you want to help the good guys win, feed your soil.
Exactly. It's all about the soil.
Steve Zion, 45 years experience in organic horticulture and soil science here in Northern California. Good information. We'll have you back sometime soon to talk about the benefits of a lot of other things like mulch.
I'd be happy to do so.
I thought you would. He's retired now, but he's happily rooting for the Green Bay Packers.
And the Milwaukee Brewers, but they're not playing yet.
Yes, or the Badgers.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Bucky.
Yes. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
Well, for many of us, the shelter-in-place rules, they're still around. Yet, most areas do allow you to take the family out for walks. And you should. Because there awaits great opportunities for you to break out in smiles. And you know what? Make somebody else smile as well. All you have to remember is gardeners are the friendliest people. So as you meander along on your daily walk, perhaps you will come across an outstanding-looking front yard garden. Maybe, especially if you're out walking in the cooler part of the day, you're going to see the homeowner working on their yard. Well, why not pause your walk, say hello, and then say something nice to that fellow gardener about their yard. Maybe praise a certain plant they have. Maybe it's the artistic arrangement of the landscape. Perhaps ask a question about what other ornamental plants they might have. What vegetables are you growing in the backyard? And I'll tell you something, if the front yard looks great, the backyard is probably awesome. Chances are, if you ask that question, the smiling homeowner will say, "Oh, do you want to see it?" Do it. Get back there. Go see it. Not only will you be enveloped in the warmth of someone else's creativity and beauty, you're probably going to get some good garden ideas for your own yard. There's going to be smiles all around. And all you have to remember, gardeners are the friendliest people. Thank you for listening to the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. I appreciate your ears. How about a subscription? You can get the podcast wherever podcasts are given away, such as Apple, Spotify, Google, iHeart, Stitcher, and many more.